Andy Hayes, sorry to bother so late. I was hoping to talk to you about a job. It's a sensitive matter, she added quickly. Hey folks, how you doing? Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. We all appreciate you tuning in very, very much. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Andrew Welsh Huggins brings us our first story, and it's called From Another Angle. The knock came a few minutes past 10 at night. There's a better than even chance I would have been in bed by that time, but for trying to help Joe with his math homework. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm always up for an adventure. But does a private eye's walk down mean streets count if he does it in his pajamas? Yeah, I said, opening the door and scanning my visitor for signs of weapons or subpoenas. Andy Hayes? Impatiently, I confirmed the information to the woman standing before me. I'm sorry to bother so late. I was hoping to talk to you about a job. It's a sensitive matter, she added quickly. It had better this time of night, and sorry, not sorry for the question, but is your phone broken? I'm listed, as they used to say. We felt it better in person. We? Well, I'm happy to explain further if... She looked past me through the door. Good for you. I glanced behind me and saw Joe on the couch, eyeing the interaction with his usual quiet curiosity. I turned back to my visitor. I put her at around my age, so mid-40s-ish. Black, hair pulled back, a spray of freckles on her cheeks, wearing a gray cowl neck sweater, silver teardrop earrings, and a nice-fitting pair of jeans. Admittedly, I've had less savory late-night visitors. Okay, give me your elevator pitch to be sure we're not wasting each other's time or sleep quota, and no offense, but make it snappy. All right, she said, clearing her throat. There's a good man who may be in trouble, and the democratic ideals that make this state great could be in jeopardy. I couldn't help myself. Despite the late hour, I burst out laughing. She frowned at my reaction. Also, she added, crossing her arms, I can pay. A lot. Never bury the lead, I said, opening the door all the way. I introduced her to my son, who said hi and went back to his schoolwork. Since he left my ex's house and began living with me, Joe has seen a lot, and a late-night visitor drew the short end of the stick for him in terms of excitement. No gunplay? Nah, not interested. I sat us at my dining room table with two glasses of water. A moment later, Hopalong crept into my room, toenails clicking on the hardwood floor, and sank with a sigh by my feet. My guest reached over and scratched him between the ears. A good start in my book. So, who are you, and who's this good man? What are the chances we could do this anonymously? Imagine the worst Vegas odds ever. What I figured. And what I told my boss. Who is? I'll get to that. Fine, as long as it's in the next 2 minutes. She introduced herself as Kim Walker, a policy analyst for the Democratic Caucus in the Ohio House. Mention of the State House made me sit up a little straighter, but not out of respect. You know who Jeff Easterday is? I thought about it. He's a lawmaker, right? From Columbus? Correct. The assistant minority leader just finishing his third term. So, number two in the power hierarchy. Oh, very good. The minority leader, Roberta Williams, my boss, is term limited, so Jeff is on track to vie for her job next year. Or was, I should say. Was? Something's wrong. His behavior's become erratic. He's missed committee meetings, floor votes, caucus events. He even skipped one of his own fundraisers. The leader demanded answers, but she says he won't tell her anything. Any theories? I ticked off the usual list: an affair, money problems, an out-of-control addiction. Well, we've considered all of those. She says she asked him directly about his finances, but he told her to mind her own business. Same with an affair. He's happily married, if that's worth anything. It's not, at least in my experience. I take it that his refusal to answer isn't good enough. I still wasn't thrilled by the late-night interruption, and the notion of taking on a statehouse job was bringing up some supremely bad memories. But she had my attention, for now, even beyond the mention of a hefty payday.
Hey, Dad?
Joe said, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine.
He handed his tablet to me.
Any idea how to solve this one? There's these three triangles on top of each other, and I'm supposed to find the length of this part, down here.
The trigonometry problem swam before my eyes, as comprehensible as upside-down hieroglyphics. Not this time, pal. Grandma's probably still up. You could do a video call with her. My mother, a former high school math teacher, had become a night owl upon retirement. I knew she wouldn't mind the interruption. I also knew Joe had a thing about bothering her.
Oh, okay, he said, hesitancy in his voice.
Here, Walker said, reaching for the tablet. She studied the problem.
The angles are the key to these problems, she said after a minute. Use the formula for tan on this triangle and this triangle. That gives you two equations involving the length you want. So, you solve them.
Oh, wow, thanks.
Well, I'm impressed, I said.
Nah, don't be. I was always good at it, and I figure it always comes down to the angles.
Anyway, she continued with the minority leader's concerns about Jeff Easterday and his unorthodox behavior.
If the other side stumbles across the real explanation, and it's as bad as we think it could be, they won't hesitate to figure out a way to use it against Jeff, against us. That goes for people in our caucus as well. He's favored to win the leadership position, but he's not a shoo-in.
I take it you're Team Easterday?
I work for the minority leader. I'm partisan politically, but neutral within the caucus. I do her bidding, and her bidding is we need to find out what's happening.
In other words, you want me to look into his situation, follow him, records check, that kind of thing? When she nodded in affirmation, I added, not that I'm not looking for work, but seems like you'd have the resources to do that yourselves.
The resources? Yeah, maybe, Walker said. But there's a question of efficiencies, not to mention the discretion this kind of investigation requires. The leader thinks it's best done outside the tent.
I dirty my hands so you don't have to?
I wouldn't have put it that way, but sure. And like I said, I can pay.
Well, I appreciate that. But before we go any further, just curious, are you aware of my history with the statehouse?
I am, she said, her brown eyes meeting mine without hesitation.
And you're still willing to hire me?
That's why I'm here.
I was skeptical. A few years back, a reporter engaged me to provide bodyguard services after his investigation of a sensitive state government story led to veiled threats. When I fell down on the job, or more accurately, fell unconscious after someone slipped me a Mickey Finn, he ended up murdered inside the Capitol. My redemption in the matter involved stopping the assassination of the then-governor a week later, smoothing things over a tad. But I was still wary of the place, and many people associated with it were just as wary of me to this day.
I'll guess I'll take your word for it. If I agree to this, how soon do you need the information, assuming I turn anything up?
As soon as possible. Lame duck sessions start right after Thanksgiving.
Caucus elections come in January. The new minority leader, whoever they are, will have the most power in a generation thanks to redistricting, which has shrunk the number of Republican seats. It's crucial we have a strong leader in position to preserve the democratic ideals or make this state great. A smirk crossed Walker's face. Or make life a living hell for the other side, whichever comes first.
After Walker left, I went straight to work. On her. Accepting the job hadn't taken much persuasion in the end, especially after she doubled my fee without prompting. Had she wanted me to dig up dirt on the other side, it would have been a different story. Generally speaking, I'm about as political as a pig wedged between two troughs of slop. But I already had a nagging credibility problem in town as the guy who blew the National College Football Championship a couple of decades ago, back when people said my name and star Ohio State quarterback in the same sentence without choking on the words. Earning a reputation as a hatchet man for either party, red or blue, wasn't going to help matters. But an inter-party investigation? At that fee, that was a different story. Despite the hour, I Googled Walker, found her on social media, and ran a bare-bones records check. She seemed legitimate. Otterbein grad, state house legislative aide, out of college who slowly climbed the caucus ladder. Single mom of two boys, so we had that much in common. Apparently a cat person, so that part, not so much. Next up, her boss, Minority Leader Roberta Williams. She was an Eastern Ohio Democrat in her fourth and final term, rumored to be eyeing a run for Congress in 2 years. She regularly butted heads with Mike Lott, the Republican Speaker, over everything from abortion to school funding, while occasionally making nice on legislation promoting things like the state's energy industry. The latter, a political necessity, no doubt, given Eastern Ohio's abundant coal, oil, and gas fields. Finding no red flags with Williams, so to speak, I created a file on Jeff Easterday. 30 minutes later, I stood up, stretched my back, shooed Joe to bed, let Hopalong out to water the grass a last time, and tried to decipher what I had. Well, it wasn't much. Easterday was 51, white, a lawyer on his second marriage, but who wasn't anymore, representing a swath of the Democratic-leaning neighborhood north of campus known as Clintonville. Father of two teenagers, boy and girl, financially solvent as far as I could tell, and not prone to headlines that didn't involve bill introductions and campaign speeches. As far as what was bugging him, well, it appeared that would take more than online digging, and not in my pajamas either. At 10:30 the next morning, Kim Walker texted to let me know that Easterday hadn't shown up for a regularly scheduled Services and Utilities Committee hearing where he was the top-ranking Democrat on the Republican-controlled panel that handled issues related to gas companies and other energy producers. I took that as my cue, fired up my Honda Odyssey and drove up 4th Street, and then over to High and onto the heart of Clintonville, a genial land of well-preserved older homes, antique stores, and coffee shops all the way to the horizon. Easterday's house sat 3 streets over from the Park of Roses, his home a nice-looking Dutch colonial, with a wide front lawn sloping down to the street. Making my job easier, his blue Acura SUV with OHREP21 plates, description courtesy of Walker, sat in the driveway. I parked 4 houses up, secure in the knowledge that the magnetic
It's a glass window cleaners sign that I'd affix to the side of the Odyssey would buy me an hour or two of undisturbed surveillance. As things turned out, I didn't need nearly that long. A few minutes after 11:30, Easterday emerged and walked toward his car. He looked preoccupied, head down and frowning slightly, but so did half the human race at this point in time. He backed down the drive and drove east, as I followed in his wake. In another few minutes, we drove south onto 71. Traffic was light that time of day, the morning commute over and still early for the midday bump, so I was careful to stay 3 and sometimes 4 car lengths back. We drove through downtown and continued south until we reached the 270 outer belt. There, he went west toward Grove City, a booming suburb bearing about as much resemblance to Clintonville as an Applebee's to a vegan deli. He exited onto Stringtown Road and a few minutes later parked in a Hampton Inn lot. I positioned myself several cars back, close to the exit. For a minute, nothing happened. Then, out of the corner of my eye, I spied a woman emerging from a dark SUV and approaching his car. She was wearing a navy suit, a hairband, pulling shoulder-length blonde hair away from a face younger than either Easterday or me, with an athletic stride that exuded energy. Tale as old as time, I thought, almost disappointed. I checked my watch, nearly 12. There was a reason such liaisons were called nooners. Furthering my suspicion, they greeted each other non-committally, exactly the way two people someplace they shouldn't have been together, and at that time of day, would have. Years ago, I was guilty of the same behavior. Joe's mom, after all, was one of my two ex-wives. Easterday and the woman stayed put for a moment while she said something, and he cocked his head to listen, which gave me just enough time to snap off some discreet photos before they stepped inside the hotel. My guess was Easterday would now spend the next few minutes enjoying himself a lot more than fellow members of the House Services and Utilities Committee, though I was congratulating myself on earning perhaps the easiest large fee in my career in record time. I knew that due diligence required I await the happy couple's reemergence just to be sure I didn't miss any other misbehavior. In the interim, I texted the photos along with my current location to Kim Walker, my new favorite math whiz. She replied with a thumbs up and nothing more. Several minutes passed and then several more. Nearly an hour went by with no sign yet of the woman or Easterday, lucky bastard, I thought. And then my phone buzzed with a text. I stared at the message from Walker. Thank you. Your services are no longer required. Please drop further inquiries. Interesting. I must have hit the mother lode with my pictures. The identity of the woman, whoever she was, apparently tripped alarm bells high up the caucus ladder and fast. My dismissal felt a little abrupt, and out of pure curiosity, I wanted to know more. But I had no standing, especially since I'd been paid in full up front. Okay, I replied and pocketed the phone as I prepared to leave. And that's when I saw Easterday emerge from the hotel alone and knew something wasn't right. There was no other word for it. The lawmaker looked stricken. His grim expression was not that of someone who'd spent the lunchtime hour indulging in some extramarital carnal pleasure. He looked like a man who'd just left the bedside of a dying child. I almost turned away out of compassion, but fortunately kept gawking instead. As I watched Easterday walk across the parking lot, a nondescript blue panel van rolled slowly past him, momentarily blocking my view. As the van continued on, I did a double take. Easterday was gone. One moment there, the van passed, and then nothing. 10 seconds after that, the van accelerated and sped out of the hotel parking lot much faster than necessary. Oh, jeez, I thought. Easter Day had been snatched in plain view. I started my own van and pulled into traffic 3 cars behind, and as I did, I unsuccessfully fought off a sinking feeling. Could it really be a coincidence that someone grabbed Easter Day less than an hour after I texted photos of him and an apparent paramour to Kim Walker? Do the math on that one. 20 minutes later, we were off the highway and headed up South High, only a few miles from Columbus's burgeoning city center, but light years away to judge by the mismatched jumble of fast food joints, half-vacant office plazas, and empty brown fields. The van traveled north for a quarter mile, then turned left onto a light manufacturing site that seemed curiously absent of vehicles. Carefully, I made the turn, following the van's progress past 3 low-slung windowless cinder block buildings, each with a for sale sign on the door. As the van rounded the corner of the 4th building, I stopped, seeing a field in the distance backing up to the Scioto River and realizing we'd reached the rear of the facility. At any other time, I would have found the sight of the field's autumn-blooming goldenrod beautiful. But now, it dawned on me how remote the area was. Though it was the middle of the day, it might have been midnight for all the help I could have summoned at that moment. The truth of that observation hit home a moment later as, peering around the corner, I watched 2 men emerge from the van, open the middle door, and drag Easter Day out. They were big guys, the size of the opposing linebackers who used to tape my name to their helmets. And not to indulge in stereotypes or anything, it didn't seem like Statehouse pages running a lunchtime errand. Looking around, one of the men used a key to open a gray metal door, and the trio disappeared inside. I wasn't sure what Easter Day was embroiled in, whether he was a good guy or bad, but 2 things occurred to me as I retrieved the Louisville Slugger from my van that I store there for protection or the unlikely call-up to the majors. First, Easter Day was in trouble, in what didn't appear to be a fair fight. Second, it looked like I was to blame, either Kim Walker or Minority Leader Roberta Williams, or both, had played me. And I wasn't happy about it, regardless of how much they paid. Cash up front or not, no one likes to be duped. Plus, exposing a philandering lawmaker to his associates was one thing. Standing by while 2 Neanderthals beat the daylights out of him, or worse, thanks to the results of my surveillance, was another matter altogether. Unfortunately, my options were limited. I wasn't sure I, or Easter Day, had time for a 911 call. As for me, my long-ago federal felony conviction for point shaving precluded me from carrying a firearm, so I was stuck with a solid stick of northern ash in my right hand. I was only mildly worried. It had bailed me out of tenser situations, and not just those with a 3-2 count and bases loaded. Creeping around the corner, I followed the line of building to the metal door through which Easter Day had disappeared. Gingerly, I tried the knob, but it was locked. Simultaneously, I heard what sounded like a muffled scream from inside. Time was running out. I raised the bat and smashed the door 3 times, the wood stinging my hands as the blow fell. I waited a count of 5, repeated the action, then crossed over and stood on the opposite side of the door from the direction it would open. I didn't have long to wait. 10 seconds later, the first of the freezer-sized gentlemen emerged, fire in his eyes. I put the flames out with a word, stepping back as he fell, pupils crossing from the tap of the bat I administered to the back of his head. I dragged him away from the door, confiscated the ridiculously large semi-automatic pistol he tucked into his waistband, released the magazine, drew back the slide and unchambered the live round, and tossed everything behind me. And waited. And not for long. 30 seconds later, the second man emerged, I repeated the drill, and that's when I ran into trouble. I'd gone with a bunt on the first guy, but the same motion merely caused this fellow to stagger slightly before righting himself, swearing loudly, and reaching for his own gun. I had just enough sense to quickly bring the bat down a second time on his hand, a blow landing with a painful-sounding crack that set the weapon to the ground. But if my previous efforts had quenched the fire in the initial guy's pupils, I only managed to stoke it in opponent number two. Faster than I would have imagined, possibly given the blows he'd taken, he rushed forward with a grunt and landed a roundhouse right that sent me to the ground, momentarily blinded by the fireworks going off in my head. When I looked up, he was retrieving his weapon and not with the demeanor of someone inclined to holster it. I was guessing I didn't have long, which is always the downside of bringing a bat to a gunfight. That's when, for whatever reason, something Kim Walker said to me the night before popped into my head. It always comes down to the angles. I took in the V of the gunman's leg, which struck me as just slightly too narrow for someone positioning himself in a shooting stance. I took that as a cue, gripped the bat, and swung it sideways as hard as possible against his left knee. Sure enough, I caught him just off balance enough that he stumbled backwards, giving me time to scramble up and swing for the fences, sending him down for good. Taking a breath to recover, I leaned over and removed both the men's heavy boots, pulling out laces from each and binding their hands. I was guessing the restraints would have about the same staying power on guys that size as baling twine on a pair of rhinos, but the purchase of even a little time was better than nothing. I waited two more minutes to see if a third at-bat was required, and when no one else emerged, I snuck inside. I found Easter Day in the far corner of the empty warehouse, sitting on a metal folding chair, hands zip-tied behind him, an ugly bruise on his right cheek. His eyes widened as he saw me approach. I put my finger to my lips, checking the surroundings to be sure we were alone, reached into my pocket, extracted my Swiss pocket knife, and cut the ties. Who? No talking. Let's go. I helped him stand, took his arm, and guided him back to the door. I went through first, checking on my welcoming party, but fortunately, while they were starting to come to, they hadn't loosened their bonds quite yet. Assured we were safe for the moment, I force-marched Easter Day to my van. Ignoring his cries of protest as he stumbled at the pace, I put him in the passenger seat, slid behind the wheel, and gunned my way out of the complex as quickly as a 10-year-old's Honda Odyssey allows. A minute later, we were back on High Street. I headed south and drove onto the outer belt, pushing it to 70. I didn't have a destination in mind, but wanted to put as much distance between us and the mess at the warehouse as possible. "Who are you?" Easter Day said finally, curiosity replacing the terror-laced confusion that had rendered him silent up to that point. "An interested party," I said, and explained how I'd come to rescue him, starting with the assignment from Kim Walker and reviewing what I saw in the hotel parking lot. When I was finished, he lowered his head. "I am so screwed." "You're less screwed than you were 10 minutes ago. Why don't you tell me what's going on?" "Like you can fix it? I fixed them, didn't I?" He didn't respond. "Okay, let's start with the blonde. Who is she?"
"If I tell you, can you promise me to keep it confidential?"
"We're two goons with big guns past promise like that. Answer the question." He shrank into his seat like a man resigned to the will of the voters on a bad election night. "Her name's Joanna Putney." How do you know her? A pause. She's an FBI agent. I maneuvered my way around an Amazon Prime truck as we passed a sign for Three Creeks Metro Park and continued north. Go on. The story spilled out slowly at first, and then in a torrent, relief replacing tension in his eyes as he talked. I'd seen it many times before, the lightning of a load that turns into the bursting of an emotional dam. It turned out the feds were investigating a pay-to-play scandal involving legislation that benefited Buckeye Gas, the state's largest gas utility. The law in question loosened regulations that were stymieing a potentially huge fracking operation in the Tuscarawas watershed, a conservancy district in eastern Ohio meant to protect the region's rivers and streams and dams. It also happened to sit above an enormous shale formation full of natural gas. Wait a second, I said. Isn't that Roberta Williams' district? More than half of it, yeah. Slowly, a blur of headlines came back to me. Wasn't that bill a Republican priority? He confirmed it. So why are you involved? Well, they need Democratic votes, pure and simple. Part of the bill allowed Buckeye Gas a 5-year rate increase to update a bunch of aging equipment. That didn't sit well with some of the GOP's free market crowd, who said it was anti-competitive and refused to play along. So the House Speaker reached out to us. Normally, our side would have fought it purely on environmental grounds, but things were different this time around. Different how? Roberta Williams has run for Congress. It's hard as hell for a Democrat in rural Ohio anymore, but she just squeaked by in her last election. If she didn't support that bill and the jobs it would bring, she's never going to get to Washington. So far you're describing politics as usual, but why were you talking to the FBI? There's legislative arm twisting and deal making, and then there's vote buying. Vote buying? There's a dark money group handing out a lot of cash. It's untraceable, even though everybody knows it's coming from Buckeye Gas. Both Roberta Williams and the Speaker were making offers to buy votes and seal the deal. To you included? Oh, yeah. They tried to pretend it was just a campaign donation, but lipstick never looks good on a pig, no matter the shade. They weren't happy. I declined and threatened to pull me off services and utilities. That's when I called the feds. And today's meeting with Putney? Finalizing the details of my cooperation. No wonder he looked so grim emerging from the hotel. I said, and no one knew you were turncoating? Well, not as far as I could tell. Until today. I explained about my photos I texted to Walker. She stabbed you in the back and played me along the way. She must have called those thugs, or had someone call them, almost as soon as they put two and two together. Yeah, maybe, Easterday said. If it's any consolation, I don't think Walker knew what was going on. The minority leader was using her, like she used everyone else. It's not. What? Any consolation. This time, the knock came early on a Saturday morning. Early depending on what you think of as 9 o'clock, by which time I'd already been clear around Schiller Park with Hopalong and was now on my third cup of coffee. What's this? I said, staring at the brown paper bag in Kim Walker's extended hand. A peace offering? Pasties from Kalache Republic, best in town. So I've heard. What's the catch? Oh, no catch. A chance to thank you. And apologize. I had no idea, Andy. You have to believe me. I did, because by now I knew the facts were on her side, though it didn't let on right away when the indictments came down 2 weeks later. Walker's name was conspicuously absent from the list of co-conspirators, as was Easterday's, despite the feds' threats. Meanwhile, no one copped to sending two brutes to snatch Easterday after my texts to Walker, a mystery amplified by the fact that the gents were nowhere to be found by police responding to the reports of the attack later that day. Either way, the only thing Roberta Williams appeared to be running for at this point was prison trustee, a job she and the House Speaker seemed on track to share. As for me, it looked like my state house reputation remained intact, and once again there'd be no Capitol Square fruit basket at Christmas. "You know the old saying," I told Walker, "just because you weren't indicted doesn't mean you're not guilty of a prosecutable offense." "Well, now that's harsh and also a little wordy." "Yeah, probably. But I'm still seeing stars from the punch I took on Easterday's behalf. You can understand my reticence." "Yeah, fair enough," she said, disappointment crossing her face like a cloud's shadow over a sunny meadow. "Maybe one thick with goldenrod?" She set the bag down on my stoop and turned to go. "Hang on." I recalled the inadvertent way her assistance with Joe's trigonometry problem saved my life. "What?" "Maybe we can talk this out." "You sure?" "Kolotskis go a long way in this house." "Well, I was hoping you'd say that," she said, retrieving the bag and training those increasingly attractive brown eyes on me. "What made you change your mind?" "Oh, I always find it helpful to look at things from another angle," I said, opening the door all the way yet again. "What? Shenanigans in politics? Oh, come on. Obviously a fictional piece." All right, I'm going to move on to the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. This is a story by Lori Rader Day, and it's called, in brackets, "The Applause Dies." Excerpt from the 2023 International Crime Fiction Guild Awards Program. A transcript. "The Applause Dies." Marion Hammond. "Thank you. Oh, thank you. Oh, please do sit. Thank you so much. Oh, my goodness. This bauble they've handed me is quite heavy. I will place it somewhere prominent so I can recall my pleasure at finally having my life of crime recognized." Light laughter from the audience. Marion Hammond. "Some of you didn't like that joke. Some of you don't like me, I suppose. These things aren't unanimous, are they? Every crime fiction author has her detractors. She has her gushing fans, her acolytes and accolades, but she also has her collection of one-star reviews, screeds written feverishly in the dead of night and published with typos unironically intact, demanding quality writing and far less of, whatever it is she is, does, or creates. But let us admit a truth hanging over our heads tonight. Who among us hasn't made a career of one-star stuff drafted in the dead of night?" Laughter from the audience. Miriam Hammond. "Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't properly thank the Guild and its leaders for this honor. When I received notice that the Guild's Lifetime Achievement Award would be bestowed upon me, I had to check the mirror. Lifetime achievement has a certain patina to it, doesn't it? And there I was. Yes, silver hair, where once had been dark, eyes once bright behind glasses peering with confusion back at me. Unfamiliar lines in a familiar face. Oh, dear, I've sunk to cliché. I've introduced you to the vile protagonist by having her gaze into a mirror. A mirror crime, that one. Speaking of crimes, hold for laughter? No? My relationship with crime began at a tender age. Children today are indoctrinated into the world of murder along with their whole food vegan pellets through the mass shootings that plague our nation and the preparations forced upon children in an effort to help them survive one. Well, now, back in my day, perhaps yours as well, monstrous origins stories were harder to come by. We didn't know our sugared cereals would kill us or the sunshine. Simpler times when real life held simpler fears. Nuclear annihilation. Light laughter from audience. Marion Hammond. So faceless, so clean and Soviet. We only had to cower under our desks to feel we'd been given the tools to make it through another day and any terrible eventuality. The monster stowed back under the bed. Murder was something that happened only on TV, but what wondrous TV it was! All that innocence soon came to a cold, hard stop for me. As most of you already know, the biographers and, I believe the term these days is content creators, have made much of it all my life. We cannot help which town we're born to, which household, what poisons were fed along with our mother's milk. I am my parents' legacy, my mother's as well as my father's, that odd ambivalence within me, heir of both the murderer and one of his many victims, must surely be the fountain from which my earliest scribblings gushed. Thank goodness those amateur attempts are long lost, or someone would surely comb through them and make them discoverable. Evidence of crime, indeed. Maudlin teen poetry. Laughter from the audience. If these revelations are somehow a surprise to you, I direct your attention to the countless internet articles that have tried to get to the bottom of my psyche and make me somehow accountable for my own troubles. Murder walls constructed of words drawing theoretical red string from one assailable so-called fact to another in the juvenile hope of making connections between random occurrences that add up to my life. The true achievement of a lifetime, I believe, is surviving one. Surviving one or flourishing in one against all odds. Which brings us to publishing. Oh, let's not let publishing off the hook, even tonight, in this glorious, festooned grand hall, with so many of its true villains out there among us. Today's publishing landscape, as they call it, as though we were farmers, or would the writers be the oxen, do you think? Many seem to think we are and raise us for slaughter. If this publishing landscape is indeed a farm, I'd leave it to you to consider the produce it yields, to consider what fetid fertilizer we spread on the ground and what results can be expected. It is not the world we all entered so long ago with our little stories held out, our chins high and quivering. To those of us of the silver hair, what a strange world, a strange and twisting ride. As I look out to this audience, I can't help but remember that not many of the people I met as I entered this realm are still among us. My first agent, gone from this mortal coil, my first editor, my first copy editor, the first reviewer to venture an ill-conceived pan, but these are all victims of time. For the most part, as I understand it, with glaring exception, but let's not speak of actual, well, bloodshed. In any case, so many of our former colleagues have left us. Here we are, the survivors of what can only be called a killing spree perpetrated by the clock. The few, the tired. I'm assuming some of your mirror protagonists have discovered lines upon their faces, too, or I would not be standing before you tonight. You and I, well, we've lived through the highest winds and the roughest seas. Our powder and our sense of humor kept dry through sheer spite. Oh, but make no mistake, I have been very lucky. No one could have had as many narrow escapes as boisterous noise from the audience. Miriam Hammond. Oh, dear, have I upset someone? Shouting indistinct. Crowd noises while security escorts a member of the audience from the room. Miriam Hammond. Oh, my thanks to that gentleman for keeping things lively. Someone do capture his name and address so that I may send a fruit basket. Restless noise from among the audience. Miriam Hammond. Now, might be a good time for some recognition for our peacekeepers. I've just noticed a familiar face in the back of the room, in fact. Captain Alan Donaldson, a great friend of mine over these many years. Let me tell you a story, since that's what you are commending me for on this occasion. Once upon a time, my husband Rick died under quite surprising circumstances, some of you will remember. Captain Donaldson was once a newly minted detective, eager, but perhaps wet behind the ears, as the saying goes. He was tireless, just tireless, and passionate to seek justice. It's true he did some damage to my reputation at the time, but I have long ago forgiven him. He was merely doing his job, of course, and though I am not privy to every detail having to do with the investigation into Rick's death, which is, of course, still open, I do think the culprit will be caught some day with the help of our men and women in blue. A round of applause, if you will, for the captain, whose recent retirement has clearly not kept him from remaining in dogged pursuit of justice. Applause from the audience. Marion Hammond. A credit to his badge. Now, I've learned a great deal from my long acquaintance with the captain, although I don't believe mentorship was his goal when we first met. Laughter from the speaker. But it has been a gift, Captain Donaldson, truly, because I have been able to bring a certain verisimilitude to my wicked little stories with your help. Now, it was Captain Donaldson, in fact, whom I called when my second husband, Michael, died only a month. It's fresh, you see. The wound of having a loved one wrenched from you in such a violent manner never goes away. I have learned it all too well. Perhaps it, well, dulls with time. But I have not yet had the time required to speak of Michael's absence so casually. Indistinct noise from the microphone. Note from transcript. Crying? Miriam Hammond. Oh, thank you for humoring an old woman, but I owe so much to the men I have had the honor of calling my partners. They, each, were my world and should indeed be acknowledged here tonight, for they, each, had such a role in my life of crime as any agent or editor ever did. Rick steadied me in the early years of my career and gave me the foundation to reach for what I wanted. With his loss, I thought I would never recover my senses. Whatever the press, these web spinners, had to say about my spending of the insurance money and the sale of Rick's company. I barely remember it. I was in a tailspin. But when Michael entered my life, he brought me back from the brink and... Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me, but I think there is something here I want to say about finding love and devotion when the model you were given in your home of origin was so violent, famously violent, inescapable. My father, being who he was, you might expect me to be something I am not, a monster. Maybe I have told this story elsewhere, but I believe this audience would like to hear it. When my father finally met with justice, the messy kind, if you'll remember, he was usually so skilled with his knife, I was on hand to receive the police, the reporters. I was covered in his blood, of course. Almost everything in the house was, if you've seen the photos. Those first on the scene believed I was a victim of my father's crime, and that couldn't be further from the truth. I was never just the victim of my parents' crimes. I collapsed them both together here for expedience's sake. I have benefited from those crimes by embracing them. The attention my parents could not provide, I have received. I turned the grisly details into fiction you have all read and now honor into a career. A lucrative one. Indeed, you could say, I learned a great deal from my parents. Indeterminate noise from the crowd. Miriam Hammond. Oh, some of you rather dislike that. I see jackets being put on, valet tickets in hands. Let me wrap up quickly before we're left with too many desserts. All I meant to say was that, even with such a rocky beginning, I have managed something vital to human happiness that my dear parents, yes, I love them no matter the suffering they caused, something they never knew, love, joy. This lifetime has been fraught with loss and despair. With suspicion, Captain Donaldson, don't think I don't know that you're here lurking in the back of the room in the hopes some bon mot will fall from my lips that will cinch my wrists at last. This lifetime you celebrate has been a trial, and I mean that in both ways, both an ordeal to bear and withstand and a tribunal in the court of public opinion. But it has also been far more than that. Perhaps my choice of career has kept me in this harsh spotlight, but it was my father's crimes that put me there in the first place. I suffered his crimes again and again, apologizing for pains I did not cause, apologizing in a way for my own survival, my own thriving, my own health and bloom, my own fortitude and eventual success. But since we are here, in part, let's not discount the other awards handed out tonight, those heavy, heavy obelisks, now to be perched like so many murder weapons in so many homes. Since we are here to honor this lifetime, mine, allow me this one moment to let the judgments and suspicions drop away to exult, to crow just this once that I survived the worst our species has to mete out against one another, that I pulled the pieces together to create myself anew, someone capable of love and worthy of it, twice, at least twice in this lifetime, and perhaps I'm not done yet. Indeterminate noise. Miriam Hammond. As old as the protagonist in the mirror looks, she's still brimming with lifeblood and vitality, strong as an ox for the fertile fields where we all toil. There are many crimes against the written word left in this old broad, but thanks for trying to put the punctuation mark at the end of all with this heavy memento and a play for a line in my obituary. Lifetime Achievement winner. Nice try, fellas. You'll have to get in a long line to become part of this bitch's obit if Captain Donaldson's men have anything to say about it. Crowd jeering. Miriam Hammond. I see the telltale signs of an escort off the stage, the hook, vaudeville style. But before I go, since I asked you to forgive my gloating, I want to follow through. One crow of glory as I stand here on this stage for what will obviously be the last time. My father, my mother, my husbands, that agent and the one that came after, the people who dared to think they knew my work better than I knew it myself, none of them are standing here before you. Indistinct noise. Note from transcriptionist. Another voice. A scuffle for the microphone. Marion Hammond. None of them live this lifetime, baby. None of them. Me. I'm the one who accomplished everything she ever set out to do. No matter who stood in her way, I did it. I did it. I did it all.
End excerpt. She did it all like all or all. Folks, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sound of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining me. Tune in again next time, will you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.